Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week is the second part of my two-part conversation with Valerie Garver, Gabrielle Story, and Carol Parrish Jameson. It is also the final podcast of Season 12 of Electric Boogaloo. This week we are discussing a Sansa chapter, and this chapter represents the first real conversation that Sansa has with Tyrion. And it's in this conversation that Sansa lies effectively for the first time, which I thought was fascinating. At the end of this podcast, I include a clip from my other podcast called Properly Howard, where comedian Steve Osborne and I review films. And this is about 10 minutes of us talking about the new Jack Harlow joint, White Men Can't Jump. So if you want to stick around after this podcast is through, you'll hear the first 10 minutes of that conversation. In that clip, there will be no spoilers. Okay, let's get to the final podcast of Season 12 with Doctors Carol Parrish Jameson, Valerie Garver, and Gabrielle Story. Val, you're welcome to stick around as long as you like.
Okay.
I mean, it's up to you.
I'll stick around. Okay. I've got at least a half an hour.
Okay, let's jump into part two. So let me read my synopsis of Sansa POV 3. As Sansa prepares herself to meet Joffrey, the Hound hurries her. Once before Joffrey, she is made to answer for Robb's treasons and the rumors of his dark magic. Dantos tries to intercede, but Joffrey orders that she is stripped and beaten. When Tyrion arrives, he puts a stop to it and schools his nephew about the recent history of unjust kings. Sansa is removed to the Tower of the Hand. After a short sleep, Tyrion returns, discusses recent events, and tells her that he intends to dissolve her betrothal to Joffrey. Carol, let's start with you. What interested you most about this chapter?
I was most interested in Sansa's character development, how she's using chivalry and romance and the things that she so believed in. If we think about her trajectory, yeah. I'm thinking back to the tournament where she first saw the Knight of the Flowers, and she had all these ideals about what makes a knight, what makes a true knight, and now here she is in this absolute circus of a court. and you know, I think Sophie Turner is a fantastic actress, but this chapter really gets into her head, and we can see that the discrepancy. She's still playing the game of being the little bird, as the Hound calls her, and saying the things that she knows she would be expected to say. But increasingly, you know, there's this dialogue she's having with herself, and she's thinking these thoughts about what's actually going on. And we see her becoming, number one, very disillusioned, obviously, but she also, she's using the things that she was taught. She's beginning to use them in a very savvy way. So I think it's a great follow-up to the chapter on Catelyn, because we see her being very, she knows, you know, well, I'm always loyal to Joffrey, that's what she has to say to survive. So what used to be a romantic visions now just become kind of defense mechanisms for her.
To use a modern analogy, I thought total loss of faith, you know, sort of like in book one, she's a total, just a total devotee of the idea of chivalry, right? Mm-hmm. In this chapter, she has lost all faith in chivalry as a concept.
She has. And she's unwilling, I think, to see who's there really to help her as well. I mean, Ser Dantos, obviously, but I'll want to hear what the rest of you think about the Hound, but I'm a big fan of the Hound. and I think he's trying to help her, but he doesn't look a way that she thinks one should look. I mean, he's scary to her. And Tyrion, likewise, is being kind and trying to help her, but she still has enough of that image that they don't look the way that she thinks someone who can help her should look.
Yeah, I would agree, Carol. I was really struck by the exact same thing, is that she's completely disenchanted with what knighthood is, but she hasn't made that like extra step to say, okay, well, if knighthood is a farce, then who are the good people? Right. It's like, she doesn't recognize it because she's still like working her way out of it. But I thought like, it's a nice part of her character development. I've always thought of her as the character who's like best developed across the books, in the sense that you actually can see her change, and she changes gradually in a way that like seems quite believable.
Right.
But yeah, I was really struck by the same thing. So I'm really glad you brought this up.
Yeah. I mean, she was just so struck by her vulnerability, and I picked up on the same thing as you two. And, you know, after Tyrion rescues her, and she's just like, is it a trick? You know, who can I trust? And again, there's a reference to her age being 12-year-old. And even though medieval 12-year-olds were very different to our modern day 12-year-olds, that's still a difficult age to work out who you're going to be able to trust next. When, as you say, you've become disenchanted, you've had your dreams or your interpretation shattered.
She notices a couple times, all right, she notices, I'm always interested to see how she's viewing the Hound. I think that what I noticed at first was she notices something different in his tone when he's trying to hurry her. And it's almost like she's sort of picking up on his nervousness, like he knows what's going to happen to her. And he knows that this is going to be worse than usual. And then when she kneels and then he helps her up, she notices that it says not ungently. So it's almost like she's perceiving he could be rougher than he's showing. And then, you know, later on in the chapter, she's reflecting on knighthood and she says, well, Sandor hates knights. And then she says, and so do I. And so I think that she's kind of coming around to this notion that maybe he has the right of it. Maybe he actually is the person to emulate in this case.
Yeah. And she also, isn't it his cloak that she gets? That seems like a significant issue too, is that, I mean, it says something about the Hound, but it also says something about Sansa that like, in a sense, he's offering her a kind of protection, like, and that you see that also symbolically. But she still says she has to walk on the side of his face that's not burned, right. Which is really like striking. Like, oh, it only goes so far, apparently.
Yeah.
She hasn't quite let go of the superficial, I say. I mean, later on from her perspective, you get to see Tyrion's face, and it almost says that she was fascinated with it. Then you have the view of Sandor's face, and so she hasn't quite let go of, you know, that, you know, there's more than meets the eye here. But I think she's coming around to this idea with the Hound, at least.
Yeah, she's had her her beliefs kind of completely shattered through all of this. I think Lancel, I guess, has the right look, but early on, yeah, he's disappointed her. And so she's really having to shift her perspective, and it takes a bit, I guess.
Same with Joffrey, right?
Right.
It's been a while since she had any notions that he was handsome, but that's what she thought initially.
10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre, We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Gabby, do you have anything in terms of like an observation or a question for the group relating to this chapter?
Yeah, so I was kind of thinking about, again, Sansa's character development. Again, we see the glimmers of this here, and I'm just kind of thinking, you know, how do we feel about her transition from that kind of helpless victim to a woman of agency? You know, what do we think about where she is right now? You know, 12 years old, she's been half stripped and beaten and so on. And, you know, what do we think about her kind of transition from this outset?
It's a good question. I think in this chapter, she's in that moment where that transition is happening, right? It's like happening in real time. She isn't there. I don't think she's completely a woman of agency yet, but I think we're beginning to see those thought processes in this chapter, which make it really fascinating to me.
Hmm. Yeah. And thinking back to our discussion of the chapter just before this last week, I'm also struck by the fact that she would have had Catelyn as a role model, right? And grown up seeing Catelyn like navigate this very a world that's very difficult for women, but doing so successfully in many respects. And so I think it's like the two chapters sort of stand as a nice contrast to one another, in that Catelyn is showing a kind of mature sense of like she's going to exert as much agency as she is able to. But then you can see Sansa figuring this out, and Sansa obviously does not refer to this or think back to this, but surely her time with her mother at Winterfell was like pretty instrumental in her understanding of the way the world is. Mm. So in a sense, she's moving from this idea that she has from like romances and songs and things like that to a more kind of realistic sense that may be more grounded in her experiences, not just in King's Landing, but also, you know, in Winterfell and growing up and seeing kind of other models for how women navigate this world.
Yeah, absolutely. And where you've just mentioned that, having Catelyn as a role model, I didn't just think of the fact that she's now got Cersei as the person who potentially look up to and be a role model, you know, as a potential new mother-in-law. And that's going to be a massive shift, because Cersei certainly rules in a very different way to Catelyn, but that's got to be quite an earth-shattering change as well, seeing a very different type of female power on display.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I noticed that she won a very small victory with Joffrey. You know, nothing to write home about. But the narrative has been that, you know, that he was ravaged by a direwolf. And, you know, they build this, I guess Cersei says they're going to build a statue in his honor to explain the scars on his arm, that he fought a direwolf and slew the direwolf. But in this chapter, she gets him to admit that it was actually Ned that killed Lady and not the direwolf that ravaged him. And then, of course, he goes on to brag that he killed these helpless people who were just hungry and begging for food. But in this place where everything sort of runs on lies, it's like a lie machine. she gets him to tell the truth. And I thought, you know, he's not smart enough to continue to keep the narrative up. He's angry and he's trying to display his power in a very ineffectual way. And in his feelings, he's unable to stick with the narrative.
Yeah, I think he exemplifies the dangers of a child king. If that child king is is not mature and prepared.
And also kind of danger in like the wrong kind of myth making. Like, I think it almost is like an object lesson. And, you know, like it shows that Cersei maybe is not so smart as she thinks, that maybe this wasn't a good story to try to tell. Right. Like there's a sort of like, you have to have a certain kind of intelligence about how you tell the story and the bounds of the story. And this maybe went too far and the truth was bound to come out. But like, I hadn't thought about that, but I do like that you point out that she gets him to admit that.
So let's stick with you, Val. Did you have a observation or a question for the group?
Yeah, I mean, to me, this chapter really struck me as this kind of contrast that I think, you know, you and I've talked about before, Anthony, about the contrast or the kind of interplay between book learning in this world and a kind of intelligence based on like studying and reading, very probably best exemplified by Tyrion, but also kind of practical knowledge and where the two come into conflict with one another. And I think like you see this both with Sansa in this chapter for sure, as we've already discussed, but also to an extent you kind of see it with Tyrion, where at the end he says about Sansa, oh, you might be wiser than we thought. But in a sense, you can see he has a kind of like respect for her, like ability to kind of navigate this world that's not necessarily based on a kind of like learned knowledge. And I feel like this has been, it's one of a kind of set of themes that goes through the whole book series about what kinds of knowledge are best going to help you. And maybe it depends a little bit on the person, but I was really struck by that and kind of wondered what, if that had struck other people, that that was part of this chapter as well or not.
Yeah, what struck me too is then she manages to outwit, in a way, Tyrion by, she manages to get herself back to her own room.
Yeah.
Because and then, yeah, he is a very smart character, but she manages to convince him that, you know, she can go back to her own room. So yeah, so she, he's right. He's got it right. And then she shows us.
In order to do that, she kind of has to craft a lie kind of in the moment and uses a bit of her own trauma to do it, right? So she's using a kernel of truth, like, this room reminds me of my father's horrific death, which is true. But then she says, I don't think I'm going to be able to sleep because of the ghosts. And, you know, I think that, I don't know if Tyrion believes it, or maybe he just admires that she's, you know, she's able to do this pretty effectively, but it works. She absolutely gets herself back to her own room.
And I think it like feeds into what we were talking about earlier, like that the tale that Cersei and Joffrey spin about the direwolf isn't working out because it isn't told the right way. There's like a hole, there's holes in it or something. There's opportunities for someone to call on it. But like Sansa, on the other hand, is good at crafting a story and saying just little enough, but just enough to get what she wants.
Yeah, and I think this is also an indication, again, of how her character is going to go in terms of that she knows she now needs to start being a player of the court. And that means crafting stories. That means an amount of deception in order to survive.
Talking about deception, I noted that there's sort of this mythology that's being built around Rob. To explain his victory on the battlefields, and that is that he's using sorcery of some kind. And I thought, you know, sort of classic demonization of someone's enemies, you know, to put them on, you know, to sort of paint them darkly. And of course, this speaks to the kind of knowledge, a different kind of knowledge, right, Val? It's like, this is sort of oral. I mean, it's rumor. It's rumor and propaganda all at the same time.
And it may also be a kind of desperation to explain a terrible battle. Like, I think that's how Tyrion kind of presents it. He's like, well, you know, your brother didn't really do these things. He just sent his direwolf in. Like, and Tyrion wants to use logic. And like, it's in a sense, he's more the realist. And like, there's almost an acknowledgement. Some people will also tell this tale, not just to play up Rob's power, but if you're going to be defeated, you want it to be for a reason that doesn't, that isn't about the competence of the person you faced. It's that they had an unfair advantage, right? So it's also a way of for the Lannisters to tell a good story of their own too.
Right. And save face with what was a defeat. I love Tyrion's line about that sorcery, that sorcery is the sauce men spoon over failure to hide the flavor of their own incompetence.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that that's totally, I mean, and just sort of dredging up something from the ancient world, the ancient Near East. It was, every battle was peppered with some kind of credit or discredit to the gods, right? If you won the battle, it means the gods were on your side. And if you lost the battle, it must have been our fault because the gods weren't with us for some reason. There's always an element of the sacred to these episodes of violence. And these battles don't just reveal who is the stronger army. It also reveals who is the stronger god in this case, or what did the gods will in this case. I thought that was sort of an interesting parallel there with the way that Rob's battle is being spun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, we use so much medieval basis for Martin's work, but he does, again, as you've just said, bring in mythology from all sorts of times and places. And because we've got actually, you know, a diverse society in terms of having those differing religious beliefs, and therefore that means we have got multiple gods, we've got multiple histories and mythologies. I mean, obviously we have dragons, like, you know, right. We've got all sorts going on there, which is interesting to, you know, how they're all weaved together.
So I do have a question, and anyone can answer this. I think in this chapter, we see very plainly that Sansa is being treated like a hostage. She's not just Joffrey's betrothed, which, you know, is supposed to be sort of the courtly narrative, right? If Rob does something bad, especially bad, she's going to be punished. And she worries. She's like, I hope they didn't kill the Kingslayer. Or I hope they didn't beat the Kingslayer. Because if they beat Jaime, I'm dead.
You're here to answer for your brother's latest treasons.
Your Grace, whatever my traitor brother has done, I had no part. You know that. I beg you,
Sir
please.
Sir Lancel, tell her of this outrage.
Using some vile sorcery, your brother fell on Stafford Lannister with an army of wolves. Thousands of good men were butchered. After the slaughter, the Northmen feasted on the flesh of the slain.
Killing you would send your brother a message. But my mother insists on keeping you alive. Stone. Sir, we'll have to send your brother a message.
And then later on, Tyrion says something along these lines, like, if we do anything bad to you, they'll kill Jaime. So clearly there's a difference between sort of the role that is being put forth and her actual role, which is a hostage of a warring enemy.
Yeah, even, you know, she's so worried when Tyrion takes her back with him, and she's so concerned. He tells her that, you know, she's a guest, but even from, you know, this perspective, is she really just a guest? Because there is so much at stake, even though Tyrion isn't threatening her the way that Joffrey is. She's an important pawn in this political game.
And I think it speaks to, like, the situation of many hostages, like in the Middle Ages. A famous example is the son of this noblewoman, Dwoda, who's a hostage at the court of Charles the Bald. And Dwoda writes him a handbook, and it talks about things like, you have to be careful what you say to people. You need to show proper respect to the king. Like, there's this sense of, it's a precarious position to be in, and so you have to always, always be on your guard in a way that I think Sansa kind of exemplifies. But you can imagine, like, almost any hostage would have to constantly be running through all the lists of possibilities. So in that sense, I think it's like it is a nice reflection of what being a hostage in the Middle Ages may have been like.
Yeah. And also, again, just for the fact, because she is noble, she's got a very different hostage experience. Just because you're able to walk around the castle and be at court doesn't mean you're actually safe. You know, right. Obviously she's still very much at risk.
And if we contrast her with Jaime, who's the hostage on the other side, of course, is completely different situation, but he handles it very differently than she does.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's a case where sort of we have these blurry lines between being a child bride betrothed to the next king, living without your immediate family around, totally under the thumb of, I guess, an oppressive power, and being a hostage. And so just a kind of a basic question, is there that much of a difference between being a child bride and a hostage in this world?
Not if you're a peace weaver and the peace weaving goes awry. Certainly not.
Say more about that. Can you unpack that?
Yeah, I'm thinking about some examples from works like Beowulf, where you know peace weaving is so important to knit alliances, and so the bride is you know is sent off, and if it doesn't work, if it's not successful, this could be very very bad for the woman. There are countless examples of this in Beowulf, not countless, but quite a few, like Freowaru. And so you would end up being something of a hostage in your husband's home. And Val, I know you can probably speak more to this as well, but the Old English poem called Wolf or Wolf and Eadwalker.
Oh, yes.
Very ambiguous, but I've always read it, or one reading of it is that it could be about a woman in a similar situation who's been traded off in a marital exchange, and then it doesn't go well, and so she's possibly held captive.
What was the name of the title of that again?
It's called Wolf, and sometimes the title is Wolf and Eadwalker. That's the other character, possible character in that poem.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check that.
That's a great poem. And I would agree with Carol, like, yes, it definitely reflects that. And we also have like historical examples of this. They're not as clear cut, but like they've often been compared to these poetic examples where, you know, a marriage, you can tell has gone awry. One of the classic cases is like, this Carolingian king Lothar II wants to divorce his wife Thutberga, and you just see she just goes through all kinds of trials and tribulations. So I would say that I think, yeah, it could be, and it strikes me like I would have to like look ahead in the books to see if this is the same in the books as in the TV show. But I do think when Sansa and Tyrion are supposed to get married, he says something to her like, oh, it'll be better now. You won't be a prisoner. You'll be my wife. And, you know, she doesn't, Sophie Turner, the actress, doesn't say anything, but like, you know, the look on her face, and he's like, oh, it's not really much different. Right. And I think that speaks to it, but I can't remember if that's in the books or not. I think that it's a very difficult situation. So I would agree with Carol.
Yeah.
I don't know if Gabby has later versions. Oh, go ahead, Gabby.
Wait, Gabby, before that, I feel like we should thank Val and let her skedaddle.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I do have to skedaddle.
I do appreciate that. And then we'll get back to thank you so much. And then we'll jump in with Gabby again. All right. I'm sorry to interrupt, Gabby. What were you going to say?
No problem. I was going to say in the medieval world, like, marriage is not necessarily freedom for women. You know, it Sansa's reluctance is because effectively she's now passing as the property to a new person. And although Tyrion is obviously very different to Joffrey, for some women, those lines between being a bride and being a hostage might not feel that different.
right. I wanted to ask about, I almost kind of felt like Arya was haunting this chapter. So when Sansa is walking to court, she sees these cats along the way, and she's walking by the cats, and some of the cats have been killed. And I think that the implication is that Joffrey's been killing these cats. Then there's this little bit about the time that Nymeria ravaged Joffrey's arm, which that calls back Arya. And then, of course, at the end, Sansa realizes that she's been put in Arya's room. And so even though Sansa doesn't really, you know, sort of wonder, like, I wonder how Arya's doing. she doesn't really go there. But the chapter is dripping with Arya, it seems to me.
Yeah. It is, and I think we get this sense of Arya just being, to these characters, erased, right? That she barely recognizes the room.
Right.
It takes her a bit to place herself when, you know, she has to realize, oh, this was Arya's room, that Arya has just kind of been erased from the picture. They don't know where she is. It bothers me that Sansa doesn't wonder more about her sister.
Yeah, it's a very short stop, isn't it? It's like, oh, yes. This was her room, but like no concern, no you know, kind of like familial wandering or whatever. And again, we see such a division between the two sisters throughout the books until we get towards the end. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I couldn't help but wonder, what does Sansa think happened to Arya? Like, does she think that she's living happily back at Winterfell? Do you think Sansa thinks she's dead and she doesn't want to dwell on it too much because maybe she died with the rest of the Starks? I couldn't help but wonder, like, what does Sansa think happened to her sister?
The only way I guess I can justify in my mind Sansa's kind of complete disregard is that maybe she does figure Arya's dead, so she doesn't want to go there.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I'm giving her too much credit. Maybe she just really disliked her, and it just isn't her concern.
Sure. Why does Tyrion give her so much information at the
end? I wonder if he's doing it to try and show that she can trust him. You know, I think he's aware that she's weak and vulnerable and potentially needs an ally. Obviously, Tyrion's not concerned about standing up to Joffrey or his father. And we can see from later on how Tyrion and Sansa's relationship develops. So I think this might just be the beginnings of him trying to gain her trust.
Yeah, I almost got the sense that he's reaching out to her maybe to get information. Like, let me open up a conversation about Rob and I'll tell you a bunch of details. Now it's your turn to tell me a bunch of details about Rob that I can use. But to her credit, she really does hold her tongue, right? She doesn't get vulnerable at any point in that conversation.
Right. I was looking back to see how he introduced the topic, and he said, "You have a right to know why Jeffrey was so angry." Mm. But her answers, again, we have italics where she's thinking. You know, the things she's thinking and not speaking. And there are things like, Rob will kill you all, she thought. But she says, right. My brother is a vile traitor. And so she manages, you know, to get a good bit of information. I agree with you, without giving a lot. And that's pretty savvy of her, too.
I have a question for you, Gabby. I'm wondering about, all right, so when Tyrion walks in, you know, he says, what's the meaning of this? And you know, he sort of chastises the so-called knights who are beating this, you know, this defenseless girl. And then he it's almost like his will in the room takes over, even though Joffrey is clearly the king. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about power historically with child kings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, is this realistic that Tyrion would actually have the power to save Sansa in this case?
I think that really depends on your king. I think the way that Joffrey's portrayed the tyrannicalness that's been ascribed to him, I mean, there's clearly little resistance from his knights, from his followers, in how he behaves. And I mean, Tyrion is a close family member, so perhaps he's going to exercise more influence and control over his nephew, who knows, he's still young. But there's a real sense that Tyrion is playing a dangerous game by opposing Joffrey, because although he's a young king, we know that Cersei struggles to control him. And I think when we're looking for historical examples, we don't have really evidence of kings this young being this tyrannical, to kind of use as a counterpoint of, oh, well, and then he killed his uncles and did X, Y, and Z. But
they would typically have a protector, right?
Yeah.
If they were very young.
Would that protector serve in sort of a capacity of like hand of the king, or would the protector be more like, you know, like the king's guard kind of thing? And I don't even know historically if the office of Hand of the King is just an invention of Martin's, or whether you have someone like that who actually governs the kingdom for the the monarch.
Yeah, so you have regents. Typically, we get protectors or lord protectors. That's a bit more of an early modern or very late medieval concept. But you'll have a regent, and that might be the mother. So as we see with Cersei, so she's effectively regent for Joffrey. But we might see an uncle or a cousin. You might have selected nobles who are chosen to rule on the king's behalf until either he reaches a certain age, or sometimes if they then think they reach an age of kind of like decision making, I suppose, because typically we see this as around 15, maybe up to 18 is the age where majority occurs. But until that point, you will have regents making those decisions, whether to go to war, the matters about foreign policy, ruling the government, ruling the kingdom, and so forth. So really, all this power should be vested in Cersei. Joffrey should be learning about how to rule the kingdom, but he shouldn't really be holding that much power unless he's then taking up his majority and kind of pushing Cersei back from the regency. So the fact that he is effectively ruling like a spoiled child or a dangerous teenager, you know, ordering Sansa to be beaten and so forth, is difficult because he's acting out of the character of a king in many ways. He's not being properly controlled by a regent. He's not spending his time learning or studying the art of rulership and statescraft. He's effectively being left to his own devices whilst his mother does the actual governing with the council.
Well, and it seems like there's no one in Joffrey's life that says, you know, you shouldn't be bragging about killing unarmed, hungry people. Like, that actually does not make you look strong. You, for some reason, you think that makes you look strong as a king. Everyone in this room knows that basically you're just bragging about murdering a helpless person. Who there is to say you don't look the way that you think you look?
Only Tyrion, it appears.
right.
Joffrey has just has completely gone rogue, and Tyrion is the only one who seems able to speak to him, and he's not, you know, officially the protector. So it's definitely a dilemma.
I wonder if now I this is sort of just a guesswork on my part, but maybe you could help me with the idea of are certain weapons seen as maybe less masculine than others? And I'm wondering if, like, the fact that Joffrey uses a crossbow would have been seen as, well, actually, that's kind of a coward's weapon, or that's maybe a less manly weapon than a sword or something like that.
Well, a less chivalric that, you know, that... and he's aiming not only this, you know, the crossbow, an unconventional weapon, at a little girl.
Yeah. Or killing cats, or killing hungry people at the wall, or whatever. I was struck by that. It's like I'm wondering if like depending on sort of your status as a warrior, you would sort of use a different kind of weapon.
Right. Yeah. And depending on the kind of battle as well. And is it the Battle of Blackwater Bay where they want Joffrey to be seen, and then he has to be, yeah, you know, they pull him in, and
right,
and clearly he does not follow the rules, and he misuses weapons,
right,
as in killing cats, as in killing prostitutes at one point in the narrative, right?
I think so. I'm not sure if that's a show only thing, but
is that a show only thing?
Because I know that Roz is a show only creation, but I don't know if there's a hint that he does that in the books. What were we gonna say, Gabby?
And say, like, building on that lack of chivalry, I think just going back to what we were saying earlier about the knights and them, they should be the epitome of chivalry, and that's kind of shattered Sansa's like perceptions of that. Obviously, you would also expect a prince to be very chivalric and knightly and so on, and to participate a bit like Renly in jousting and tournaments and all that kind of view. So right. I think that's almost a double blow to Sansa. Like, the prince that she's hoped for is completely gone, but he's even gone even further than just not being a good husband. He is an unchivalric man. You know, he's not fitting that role in any way.
That's right.
Right, picking on young girls. And Tyrion even says, you know, it's a shame that that Stannis and Renly aren't 12-year-old girls. Then, you know, right. maybe you'd have a chance.
Right. Notable introductions in this chapter. We're introduced to the Battle of Oxcross, which we don't see on the page. Again, Martin kind of likes to tell us what the consequences are for the battle and not actually show us the battle oftentimes. Another introduction, Maester Franken. And notable departures, although we don't see it, we are introduced to Rupert Brax and Lyman Vickery and Lord Jast. All are introduced and depart simply in the story of who got massacred at Oxcross. And show differences. You know, a lot of this was in the show, except for the sort of the post-court conversation with Tyrion and Sansa. Was there anything else you observed about this chapter or wanted to talk about related to this chapter?
I might like to just spend a moment on, I mentioned earlier what a circus this Joffrey's court is, and just kind of thinking about the stage, setting the stage.
Dantos is riding a broom handle or something.
Right, with a melon on a stick what I could gather. It's just such a joke. Horace and Hobber, in my mind, I always call them Hobber and Slobber. I mean, just... it's just almost farcical.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dantos is obviously meant to be there as the bit of light relief, isn't he? Because as well, but it is very representative to a point of having, you know, the court gesture in the medieval world and so on. But it does almost add to the, like you say, the ludicrousness of this court, because on the one extreme you've got your prince who's ordering his knights to beat a 12-year-old girl, whilst on the other hand you've got your fool running around with a melon. Like, again, completely agree, Carol. Like, it is such a
it's interesting to kind of I thought that it was interesting to contrast these kings and their courts. You know, Renly has, you know, these men who are feasting and almost trying to outdo each other with who's going to be more brave in battle. And then you've got, you know, contrast that here with Joffrey, who's, you know, who's going to entertain the king most. You know, it's almost like this boy king needs to be entertained or else he'll get violent. And so Dantos is sort of trying to put on this big show, and everyone's sort of putting on a pretend. Everyone's almost plain pretend for Joffrey's sake, feels like.
Yeah, and then we can contrast that as well, I think, with Stannis's court, which we don't see, but we see him come out and we know how somber he is. And so we get three very different perspectives.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And also a real contrast to what we see of the court in the north in terms of that is perhaps somber in a sense as well, but there's a steadfast sense of loyalty there which you absolutely don't get through Joffrey's right. court. Joffrey's court is very much a rule through fear, not through loyalty.
Right. Yeah, Brienne will die for Renly at the drop of a hat. Just say the word, Renly. You know, Brienne's gonna die for Renly, but you don't get the sense that the Hound or Tyrion or anyone would do anything for Joffrey that they don't have to.
No.
I did note that here we have Sansa almost sort of wishing, like, you know, smile, Joffrey, just smile. Just smile and be amused by the fact that I'm being hit with a melon, because that will satisfy you. I noted, like, Joffrey can't, he's almost humorless, right? He doesn't understand anything besides cruelty. Like, he doesn't think anything is funny besides cruelty. And it would have to be legit cruelty in order for him to actually be amused by it. And nothing that Dantos could actually do would make Joffrey smile.
Yeah.
Got a little sense of, you know, every now and again people will point out that, you know, Trump never smiles.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't like to make fun of himself, but he does, you know, he sort of uses that old cruelty model.
Right. Yeah.
Just a tiny parallel, yeah. Noticed.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's, you know, politics shouldn't be about charisma and popularity, but you don't want to be ruled right. by someone who doesn't know what a joke is or how to right. enjoy themselves either.
I mean, Joffrey, yeah, he thinks there's power in ruling through by fear.
Yeah, he says as much, and, right?
Yeah, he says as much. And, you know, of course, Tyrion tries to counter that by mentioning, you know, the Targaryens and how that does not always, uh-huh. That does not work out. But yeah, I think he's enjoying ruling by fear.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for joining me. I really feel like I appreciate these chapters even more having this conversation. And I really think things are ramping up in this, you know, we're about halfway through the book here. And I feel like the stage is set. You know, we're actually going to see some action now.
Right.
Gabby, thank you for joining us. This was our first conversation. I hope it's not our last.
No, thank you so much for having me. I mean, rereading those chapters really opened my eyes to some new things. So this discussion's definitely, you know, changed perspectives on a few things. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah. And Carol, always lovely to talk with you.
It's always a pleasure. I also learned a lot from this discussion.
Can I ask, if you don't mind, is there anything that's available to listeners, like a book that they might purchase that you've written or contributed to, or an online article that you might mention? Some of our listeners like to know those kinds of things.
Yep. So I've recently had a podcast out with BBC History Extra on Richard I and Philip Augustus on medieval masculinities. And I will have a biography of Berengaria of Navarre out towards the end of the year.
Wonderful. Where can folks see the BBC interview?
If you search History Extra in Google, it will pop up. And I've got an author's page on there where they'll be able to find the podcast, or on my website, which would be gabriellestory.com.
Wonderful. And Carol?
Yeah, I have a book on Game of Thrones that came out in 2018 called The Chivalry of Westeros. More recently, I have an article that's coming out about secular saints in Chaucer's work, but it does concern peace weaving. So it might have some interest to our conversation today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve, how would you rank actors who were once music artists? Top four or five for you?
They made the transition from musician exclusively to...
Yeah.
This
is all kind of stuff that I could have prepped you with ahead of time.
Sure.
But I don't.
It makes for whatever it is we do.
Let me just say, part of this podcast is that you have this party trick. Well, it presents as a party trick, but it kind of goes into your psychosis where you just have this inexhaustible supply of useless knowledge about pop culture.
Sure.
Sometimes I like to showcase that.
Yeah, it's funny. The first one that came to mind was Tina Turner from
Mad Max.
Thunderdome. Yeah. And not because I put her in like the Pantheon, but like that was just like the first image that I got. Timberlake's always been solid, right?
You know what? That's so funny. I totally forgot about Timberlake. And, you know, I don't know if his movies have sort of been critically acclaimed, but his work on SNL is kind of unparalleled.
Yeah, I mean, he's really, really good there. I've seen him in some action-y things. I saw him, wasn't he in The Social Network? I've seen Beyonce.
What was Beyonce in?
I for sure saw her in the third Austin Powers Goldmember.
Okay. I forgot about that. Here's one that I don't know. Was Bette Midler a
musician exclusively?
What happened first for Bette Midler?
It almost feels like it like happened at the same time.
She might have been one of those like, sort of Broadway people who kind of could do both all the time.
How do you feel about Harry Connick Jr.?
Let's do this. Harry Connick Jr.
HCJ, as he's called in the streets.
He does amazing voice work in one of my favorite animated films of all time, The Iron Giant.
Mm.
And is sort of overlooked.
He's the mother.
He plays every part.
That's right.
Yeah, no, otherwise he was sort of in, you know, like what, Flipper or some dolphin
Independence
movie.
Day.
He was not in Independence Day.
Yeah, he was. He was the co-pilot with Will Smith early on.
Oh my gosh, you're so right. Oh well, we're bearing the lead, Will Smith.
Right. I guess so, huh? Yeah.
Will Smith.
I like how my vision of Independence Day when we're talking about famous musicians turned actors, it's the Harry Connick Jr. He was in there for like 7 minutes.
Will Smith may be top 10 action stars in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Did John Lithgow ever sing?
John Lithgow was an amazing tap dancer. So, all right. So of those mentioned, who would you sort of, I mean,
well, I guess
J-Lo,
now it's Will Smith,
J-Lo
right?
would be up there, right?
Well, she was a dancer.
Uh-huh.
I thought she was a dancer turned actress turned singer. I think that's the order it went.
All right. Got it. And then who was
Madonna is famously terrible as an actress.
Nope. She was pretty good in A League of Their Own.
Oh yeah, sure.
Sort of a supporting mm-hmm. star, right? And then most recently you've got Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga, yes.
Pretty great. I mean, as far as sort of like holding your own as the lead, I suppose it's easier to pull off what Harry Connick Jr. does than necessarily what Lady Gaga did.
Bite your tongue. He played a serial killer in a movie.
Is that right?
I believe it was Copycat with Holly Hunter.
Yeah, but he was a serial killer in real life, so it doesn't really...
Yeah.
He's sort of just playing himself, right?
Yeah, so singers turned serial killers.
Oh, speaking of that, Sinatra.
Right.
Frank Sinatra was in several movies, none of which I've seen. I've seen no Frank Sinatra movies.
And fun fact is that he was originally supposed to be John McClane in Die Hard.
Is that right?
I don't know if that's what they wanted, but the
that's
novel,
a whole different thing.
The novel that Die Hard was based off of was like a sequel to another novel that was made into a movie with Frank Sinatra. So like he had like right of first refusal. And he was like old still, you know, I mean, it wasn't. I mean, that's a very, very different film. That no one watches.
Elvis.
Elvis, probably the most movies as a musician.
Okay, so I would say that Will Smith, you know, if you're just going to measure acting career against the recording artist career,
mm-hmm.
I think Will Smith has the most success as an actor.
He had a couple hits.
But not nearly... Elvis, right? Elvis.
You don't think Big Willie style compares to anything Elvis did?
Elvis clearly was he was sort of a one of one. He was sort of a singular figure in the music world. And then made what, 10 movies? 10?
He made like 30 something movies.
I've never seen an Elvis movie.
I've seen several. I went on an Elvis kick for a while. Viva Las Vegas still stands out.
Is that his best?
In my opinion.
You don't understand.
I'll make it simple, ma'am. Your motor's broken.
Broke? But it was running perfectly when I pulled up here, except for the whistle. Are you sure you're a mechanic?
Sure I'm a mechanic. I mean, you got here just in the nick of time because we're going to dismantle this whole thing.
Completely.
It might take a whole day.
A day?
Maybe two.
Well, if you have to. Well, can you lend me a car until you have mine running again?
Well, we'll do better than that. I'll be happy to drive you wherever you want to go.
And why should you go to all that bother?
Because around here I'm known as your very bothering mechanic.
I'm sure you
the
are.
Song stands out for sure.
Yeah.
All right.
It's
so
great. I love the idea that he's, you know, he's a racer who loses his money wooing a woman because he falls into a pool, and his winnings that he was going to use to buy the engine that he needs to win the race gets sucked into the pool jets. And so now,
you know, that actually happened to me. That this is,
yes.
This...
Did you have to work as a waiter at the hotel and then enter a talent contest to get the money for the?
Yes. However, I was already registered for the talent contest. So.
Oh, okay. So just serendipitous.
The motives are a bit different, but so I think if you're going to create kind of a Mount Rushmore, I think Will Smith is on it for sure.
Yeah.
Elvis has got to be on it just because.
Just a volume?
Just not necessarily volume, but in terms of, like, he was just the biggest star in the world for, like, I think you have to measure both careers against each other, right?
And you could argue that it's the movies that killed him, right? I mean, I think that's kind of that he was getting to a point where he was, like, losing his credibility, and he was just, like, panned movie after movie. So, like, he becomes a star, but then it's, like, it just is kind of dulling the star. So then he decides, you know, well, the only thing I can do now is do that NBC special and load up on barbiturates.
Well, let's not forget that he ate fried chicken every day and never pooped for a year.
Yeah, well, that'll get you in the end, right? I mean, that's, I could do 2 months.
Get you in the end is pretty great. So I think, I mean, those two for sure. I mean, Barbara Streisand.
I was thinking Babs. I'm pretty sure she started.
Although I'll be honest, I am woefully ignorant about my Barbara Streisand
films
history. Yeah.
Oh, like Yentl.
Never saw Yentl. Never
Star
saw
is Born,
the first.
Speaking of,
never saw the first Star is Born. I love the second Star is Born for sure.
I love how we're talking about remakes, and we're eventually trying to get our way to Jack Harlow, and we actually just talked about a remake with Barbara Streisand and Lady
Gaga.
We're
at minute 10 of this podcast. I have not said Jack Harlow once. And
well, you're not going to put him on the pantheon.
I get a little credit for squeezing this out of you before we actually talk about White Man Can't Jump.
And was it John Lithgow? Was that the fourth?
I don't know. That's a good question. Well, you know, write in cocoonsofhorror.com. That's actually not an email formulation.
Nope. You just do whatever you want. You're going
to
spell it wrong
anyway.
It's
not going to get to us anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, yeah.
No, cocoonsofhorror@gmail.com. Who else would you put on this Mount Rushmore? We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. I mean, let's complete it. Yeah, we'll figure that out. I mean, I think what we're looking at is that, Snoop Dogg has certainly made himself a little niche, right? I mean, mm-hmm. He's not necessarily like leading. If we're talking about somebody who's like a lead, he may not be that.
Tone Loc was in Heat.
Yeah, and he was also in the movie.
He... He gets credit for the song Wild Thing, which sort of de facto puts him in Heat, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and Henry Rollins is also in Heat.
That's right. Oh, man.
All right. Huey Lewis was in some stuff.
Yeah, I saw his penis in Shortcuts.
Yeah. And I hear that's not as aptly named.
I'm so glad I started the way I did. What do you want out of a remake? Like, what are sort of like some criteria that you think, well, I want you to be faithful to the original spirit of the film, or I want this character to sort of embody the character I remember, or do you want actual like plot points paralleled?
That's a great question, because I don't know that I think that question assumes I want a remake.
You're the one that suggested that we cover 9 remakes.
Yeah, no, I definitely think because I think it's worth discussing. I'm gonna now go full Tim Robinson. I said it was interesting. I think it's worth looking at, right? But I mean, typically a movie is remade. Usually, you remake a successful movie, right? I mean, right. Isn't that kind of typical, or at least one that has some sort of a nostalgic place in people's hearts. So then you go, well, let's do that again. And see,
yeah, you
if
think
can...
you've got a built-in audience, right?
Yeah, which is kind of remarkable, right? I mean, it's an interesting concept that says, hey, everybody thinks this is beloved. And because it's mostly maybe because of the nostalgia factor, let's redo it and put their nostalgia to the test. And it's like, is that a good strategy? Because no, then you end up having something polarizing, right? You have people going, well, I don't want to see a remake of this. I think this is great.
Right. This is sort of like, hey, you know what everyone loves? Let's ruin it.
Right. If you're going to do a remake and you're going to get my attention, it has to be somewhat of a modern reimagining to some degree, right? Like, or maybe you can get something where it's like, if we can maintain the spirit, but now we have the effects that we didn't have before, right? Like there's plenty of movies that we look back and go, yeah, I mean, it doesn't hold up from a, you know, maybe a technological standpoint, but the story is still good. So maybe you have an opportunity to retell it, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe the movie is kind of like a guilty pleasure. You know, you like it, but you can maybe say, hey, I know it's not that good, but there's something there. There's some meat to it. So maybe if you can come and you can retell this story in a way with maybe a more, a deft hand that can pull out some of the stuff that was the good foundation, but like now create a better narrative. Like, that's what I think you'd want. I mean, it happens. And then we're going to go over these remakes and we're going to discuss. And I already know for sure one of the remakes we're going to go over is substantially better than the original.
Well, here's what I was going to say. There's another reason why you might do a remake, and that is this film appealed to, like, children of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But children in the 2020s don't watch 70s films.
Right.
So this was a film that we were sort of aiming at a particular demographic that has aged out. And so it's time that we remake this so that we can capture the new demographic. And I would say
And the story is good enough. The story may transcend generations. Mm-hmm. It just needs to be tweaked.
I would almost argue that The Force Awakens is almost a remake in that sense.
I would agree with that.
And this is going to be, you know, heresy to a lot of people, but after rewatching A New Hope, I like the remake better.
Mm.
And it may have something to do with the ages of my kids and when they experienced it for the first time. And I think A New Hope is a really amazing, iconic movie. But just in terms of storytelling, it's really hard for kids under 10 not to fall asleep in Star Wars.
Right.
So,
and you know, I mean, your lightsaber battle, your big climactic one is real, real snoozy. Right.
Well, and look, and we both have a lot of affection for that movie. I still think nothing holds a candle to Empire Strikes Back, but it's, in terms of A Force Awakens being almost a remake of A New Hope, I think that was the spirit. It was like, this movie was beloved by a generation that has kind of aged out, and we would like to capture what this was for Gen Z or something like that. I think that White Man Can't Jump may be the same kind of thing, because, you know, I rewatched White Man Can't Jump, the original.
Mm-hmm.
With Woody Harrelson and Rosie Perez and Wesley Snipes. And I think it's a better film. I just enjoy that film more.
The original?
The original more.
Mm-hmm.
And my son enjoys the remake more.
But he watched the original?
He watched some of the original, which may speak to you about how much he enjoyed the original.
Sure.
So I think that clearly the first one is a better movie, and yet this one is, which I don't hate this one, and I think it's a decent way into our discussion of remakes.
Hey, they're letting yoga instructors in the gym now.
Ball!
I just noticed you're not getting enough legs on a new shot. Are you dehydrated?
$100, you can't make more shots.
Let's just do $300.
It's not my dad's money.
You ain't never gonna get a reparation that way, bro.
So I prefer Venmo or Zelle, but you seem like a Cash App guy, so.
Ladies and gentlemen!
My son likes this one better. And who am I to argue with that?
You watch both. I feel like you have a better argument. You have a better opportunity to argue because he didn't watch the first one. So just by virtue of knowledge and experience.
All right, so let's interrogate this a bit. Do please check us out over at Properly Howard Movie Review in association with friends of the podcast, The Lorehounds, John and David.